This is BTO, Beyond the Obvious 2.0, Germany's economics podcast with Daniel Stetter.
Hello and welcome. My name is Daniel Stetter. I produce a weekly podcast on economic issues in Germany. From time to time, I interview experts from all over the world on certain issues. If these interviews are done in English, I do a German translation for my German audience. But I thought it would be valuable for many people to listen to the interviews in original. And therefore, from now on, we will publish international English language interviews in addition to my weekly podcast. Here comes the first edition, my interview with Professor Steve Keen.
Our guest today, Steve Keen. He's an Australian economist. Keen was formerly an associate professor of economics at the University of Western Sydney. In September 2014, he became head of the School of Economics History and Politics at Kingston University in London. As early as December 25, he warned of an impending global financial crisis. Keen is a critic of neoclassical theory, but also of Marxism. He accuses both social theories of inconsistency, unscientific behavior, and adherence to disproven claims. Keen's thinking about economics include John Maynard Keynes, Hyman Minsky, the Italian economist Piero Sraffa, and the Austrian economist Joseph Schumpeter, among others.
Dear Professor Keen, a warm welcome to my podcast. I'm very grateful that you take time for me.
Thank you. Good to be invited on.
You've been one of the few people predicting the financial crisis before it happened. So what led you to being able to predict it, and why do you think it was coming?
Well, there's two reasons. One is that I became exposed to the work of Hyman Minsky right back in 1987, long before he's been discovered by mainstream economists. And I found his explanation of capitalism the most compelling I'd ever encountered. So I did my PhD on modelling Minsky. He attempted to model his logic in his own PhD, building a model of financial instability on top of what's called the Hicks-Hansen-Samuelson second-order difference equation model of the trade cycle. And I already knew from my own work that that was a bad model. So I built a model on top of what's called Richard Goodwin's growth cycle model, and I've since realized that it's an even better foundation than I realized to model Minsky. And when I did the model, I first built the model in 1992, it generated a phenomenon which ended up turning up in the actual data after I'd built the model. So the first thing which happened was a major factor in Minsky's logic was rising levels of private debt causing financial instability and then a breakdown. And that's what happened in my model. But what also happened was there were diminishing cycles, diminishing volatility before the breakdown. So you had a period of falling cycles and then rising cycles. And that was quite remarkable. It was not a prediction of Minsky that that would happen. And then what we call the Great Moderation began, what the neoclassicals called the Great Moderation, began in the early 1990s as well. And they saw that as being a sign of how well they were managing the rate of inflation. And I saw it as, oh dear, is my model turning into reality? Then I got involved in checking private debt levels again in the late 2005. I had a long hiatus because I wrote a book called Debunking Economics, and I got involved in battles with neoclassicals over the content of that book. So I started looking at levels of private debt again in late 2005 as part of a court case I was involved in as an expert witness, and I saw this incredible increase in private debt in both Australia, where I lived at the time, and America, and I thought there's going to have to be a crisis because this rate of growth of debt, private debt, can't be sustained. When it breaks, there'll be a crisis. Somebody has to warn about it, at least in Australia, or that somebody. So that's where I got into it back in 2005.
So, but you know, you mentioned neoclassicals are not seeing it, but I would have thought no one was seeing it. I think the Queen was asking the question, why didn't economists see it? And I think there might be now a neoclassical dominance, or there was a neoclassical dominance, but Keynesians also didn't see it. I think Hyman Minsky wasn't somehow special in his view around the economy.
I disagree with you there to some extent, because you also had Wynne Godley, coming out with a very different form of analysis to mine, but he was saying as long ago as 1998 that the what he called the Goldilocks phase of American capitalism after the recovery from the 90s, early 90s recession under Clinton, and then the early days of Bush, he was saying this can't be sustained because there's such a high level of increase in household debt in particular that at some point households have to get their balance sheets back in order, and when they do, there'll be a crisis. So I've been definitely godly, writing with Randy Ray as well, made claims also about a crisis, and there's about a dozen other economists of different stripes who did. But the amazing thing is many non-economists saw this coming because they were worried about the level of private debt. Only economists thought you don't need to worry about the level of private debt if they were mainstream economists. Anybody outside that bracket, and that includes people as far away from me as Peter Schiff, who's an Austrian by orientation, they were the ones who warned about it. So just economics in particular made the mistake of believing the level of private debt does not matter.
Well, I remember in 2003, we had a partner meeting at Boston Consulting Group where I worked. Mm-hmm. And I had written a paper concerning taking deflation seriously, which of course was a bit too early because I spoke about private debt levels as well.
Yeah.
And we invited a senior economist who then turned up to become one of the main economists at the IMF later on. And he gave a speech and he said, debt levels don't matter because wealth is increasing much faster than debt. He said basically, asset values go up so fast, there's no need to worry. So is there a linkage between debt levels and asset values?
Yeah, that's the nonsense they always fall for because, again, according to neoclassical economic theory, there's no link between the level of debt and the level of asset prices. Now, like most things in neoclassical economics, that's an assumption. And when you take a look at the data, it's wildly contradicted by the data. For example, my logic says that the level of credit drives aggregate demand, and I can explain that logically in a watertight argument. But as part of it, you can then argue that as well as affecting demand for goods and services, it affects demand for assets as well. So I see a relationship between the level of asset prices and the level of new credit. So if you look at mortgages, you can relate the level of mortgages as a fraction of GDP to the price level for houses. And therefore what you get is the change in the level of new mortgages is related to the change in asset prices. And the same thing applies to margin debt. So if I do correlations of margin debt change in new margin debt, so acceleration of margin debt itself, and change in new mortgages, so acceleration of mortgage debt as well, I get a correlation coefficient with both house prices and share prices of 0.64. Mm-hmm. Now, that's a long way from zero. I don't care about which way the causation runs in this sense. It's way outside of what the neoclassicals believe. I'm guessing you're talking about Olivier Blanchard, by the way. Correct? Yeah.
Yes.
He's a good man. I mean, I like him as a human being, but he is so blinkered to thinking in a neoclassical frame of mind that he rules out doing the implicit work of inducing from what you see in the data what might be happening. And when you have to turn them into completely around logically and say, look, the level of private debt matters. Private debt is not an exchange from one non-bank to another non-bank, which just shuffles who has the money. And repayment does the same thing in reverse, so you can, they effectively cancel each other out. That's a world of interpersonal banking. We live in a world of private banks where banks create money when they lend, and that money is borrowed to be spent. And so the change in debt is a major contributor to aggregate demand, but it can also be a negative contributor, which is what it turned into during the financial crisis.
I think it's funny because Thomas Piketty, I'm sure you read his book Capital in the 21st Century,
and I've wrote a book. Much as I could manage, for I got bored and couldn't continue.
Yeah, I know. I wrote a German summary, criticism, and edition, as I called it, much thinner. My book was just 140 pages.
Yeah, huge amount of wasted wordage there.
But he's basically not getting it because he's not seeing that increase in leverage and increase in debt is the main cause for rising asset values. So he's if you look into his book, the only time he mentions debt is debt, see government debt. And if you then see government debt, it says wrong distribution of wealth between private sector and government sector. He's not seeing debt as being a very important driver of asset prices and therefore inequality. So just funny that
They're both wrong. I mean, if the data, I look at America, so the correlating American margin acceleration and margin debt to American stock prices, 0.64. I don't know how anybody gets You have to be massaging the data, in a sense, you're actually breaking the neck of the data to reach the results that they get where they don't find correlations. I simply don't know how they do it. I think they deserve an Olympic medal for distorting the statistical distortions. But the data is screamingly obvious that this matters.
We've seen private debt as a driver of financial instability. Now we had the crisis in 2009, and since then we have central banks intervening with quantitative easing and so on and so on. But obviously they failed to get the economy back on pre-crisis growth trends. So what's your view around how we handled the crisis? Was the reaction correct, or did we fail to correct the causes of the crisis?
Whenever a crisis hits, of course, according to neoclassical theory, a crisis can't happen. One of my favorite quotes is from, Robert Lucas, when he was made president of the American Economic Association, saying that macroeconomics succeeded in its central task of preventing depressions, and it'll never happen again. And Bernanke coming out, talking about the Great Moderation being wonderful, the OECD saying how 2008 was going to be a fantastic year. I mean, all totally, totally wrong. So, what had happened is when the crisis hit, people that they were advising panicked and thought, oh my God, we've got to... Frankly, I actually remember a quote from the Treasury Secretary, Hank Paulson, saying that he didn't want capitalism to fail on his watch. So even though these people were, you know, textbook economists, believed the mainstream, accepted all the principles of the mainstream in circumstances that did not include a crisis, when the crisis hit, they threw that out the window and threw as much money as they could get away with at the financial system. Government created money, of course, and that meant that we had a far shorter downturn in 2007, 2010 than we had back in the Great Depression. Because the scale of spending, in fact, during the Great Recession, as a percentage of GDP, was three times the size of the New Deal. So that was a huge stimulus, and that stopped us going into as deep a slump as the Great Depression. But then once it was out of the way, they not only did they take all the government supports away and had a very tepid response after 2010, they also tried to encourage the private sector to continue, get back to lending again. Now, what that meant was the level of private debt, which in the Great Depression fell from about 150% of GDP at its peak in 1932 to about 40% of GDP in 1945 after the Great Depression and the Second World War. So we had a total reset of the level of private debt. In America's case, the American data there say 150% in 1932, 40% roughly in 1945. This time around, we peaked at 170% in America and bottomed at 150. So we simply haven't removed the private debt burden in the same way that both the Great Depression and the Second World War and the New Deal reduced it last time around. So that's why I think the economy has been so stagnant. It's not Larry Summers called secular stagnation. It's credit stagnation. And the level of credit-based demand has never been as high after the crisis as it was before. And of course, people spend more slowly when they're in debt for the obvious reason they're trying to hang on to money to pay their own debts down. But by doing it, the actual turnover for money is less than it would be without the debt burden. So you have a stagnant economy.
As far as I remember, if you talk about the US, I think private households have reduced the debt level a bit, but corporations, especially the big companies, have increased the debt level significantly. I think even before the corona crisis hit, even the IMF was warning that the US corporate sector might be the area where the next financial crisis breaks out, because companies have levered up to buy back their own stocks, for example.
I'm just actually taking a look at my data program here on that front, and that's correct. The household sector did fairly dramatically reduce its debt levels. So you had a fall in household debt. My program's not working properly. As I do this, I can't bring up the stats I wanted to bring up straight away. Let's see, why they're not working. Anyway, but household debt fell from about roughly, say, 80% of GDP to 50 or 60%, and now it's back up rising again. Whereas the level of corporate debt is now higher than it's ever been. So there was the level of household, I'm getting my data now, the level of corporate debt peaked at about 72% of GDP during the financial crisis. It fell to about 65%, and it's now 75% before coronavirus. And when coronavirus hit, it's now 85% of GDP. So there's been the corporate sectors continue to speculate in that sense. Households, on the other hand, peaked at almost 100% of GDP, fell down to about 75%, and are now rising a bit as a percentage of GDP, not because they're borrowing, but because GDP has fallen, and therefore the outstanding level of debt is higher than it was beforehand.
We come to Europe later on, but just stick to the US for a moment. So now we have Corona hitting, and my understanding was, thanks to the checks sent out by Trump and by Biden, private debt levels are reduced even faster because Americans are saving more. But if you now look at the status of the US economy, would you say the financial stability is higher or lower now? Because the private household debt has come down, corporate debt has gone up. Or would you say whether it's anyhow a different game now post-corona because Biden is doing a completely different policy in pushing the economy up with huge spending programs?
Biden's making a big difference, no doubt about that. So you don't have the fear of deficits that was ingrained into Obama in Biden. In fact, by being understudy to Obama during Obama's administration, possibly Biden saw the foolishness of being obsessed about reducing the deficit. So the larger deficit spending by the government is definitely boosting the economy, and the government can afford it, of course, because as anybody who understands money knows, the government creates money when it runs a deficit. So it doesn't need to borrow. It's creating additional money, and that is stimulating the economy. But when you take a look at, I think the financial fragility is probably higher because, again, if I take a look at the level of household and corporate debt now, the corporate household debt has actually risen as a percentage of GDP, not because there's much more borrowing going on. So households at the moment, households borrowing is roughly equivalent to 2% of GDP, and it hasn't fallen during the COVID crisis, being pretty consistent. But if you take a look at the corporate sector, it's had an enormous increase in its borrowing. Its rate of borrowing went from 4% of GDP before COVID struck to 8% of GDP. So it literally doubled its rate of borrowing. And that's meant a substantial increase in corporate debt. So in that sense, it's not so much the households which are more fragile after COVID as the corporate sector. And I've got a feeling a lot of that debt's been taken on just because they had short-term commitments to meet. They had to access lines of credit or overdrafts and things of that nature. And there's been a huge increase in debt. That's only data up till September. So we've got to go a lot further to see where it might eventually get to. It's quite possible the corporate sector will come out carrying certainly the highest level of debt in the history of the American corporate sector, and possibly 15% of GDP more than it's carrying right now. And that means there'll be a lot more for corporations that are potentially fragile after coronavirus.
So, but what does it mean? Look, I just tried to summarize here. You said 2009 was similar to the Great Depression, but it was avoided thanks to government spending and thanks to stabilization of the financial sector.
Yeah.
But we paid the price of slowing down deleveraging in the private sector, or even in giving an incentive for corporations to keep on, leveraging up. Mm. Now we had Corona hitting, which was speeding up again the increase in leverage of the corporate sector, and the government is now increasing its deficit significantly, and you are a proponent of MMT, and we will come to it later on, and you say basically it doesn't really matter. But how should this now proceed? Can we continue this way, or do you think there is a need for deleveraging in the corporate sector as well?
I think we need deleveraging everywhere. I mean, in this case, neoclassical economics has played a huge role in actually encouraging increased levels of debt. If you know the Modigliani-Miller theorem, one of the many in lunatic theories of neoclassical economics, let's assume a can opener type economics, where they said, if we assume perfect foresight, you can tell the future and you get a choice between equity and debt. And if you take out equity, you can't get a tax deduction for your dividends. But if you take out interest, you can. Therefore, we advise 100% debt finance and 0% equity is sensible for a corporation. Well, what a load of bollocks! What that has meant, of course, if you have a rundown in your profit level and you have dividends, you're equity financed, then you cannot pay your shareholders. But if you have debt and there's a downturn, you cannot not pay your bank. So we've increased the fragility of the corporate sector dramatically by following neoclassical economics. And I would say, given the level of private debt compared to the golden now compared to the golden days of American capitalism from sort of 50 to 70, it's about three times what it should be. It's roughly 170% of GDP. It should be about 50% of GDP, maybe 60%. So I think we have to find some way to reduce the level of private debt by more than 100% of GDP. And then we'll get back to the financial resilience of the 50s to 70s, but not until then.
The point is, there are also data showing that digital debt in general doesn't generate much GDP anymore. I think you got in the 50s, 60s, you got for $1 of new debt, you got about $1 new GDP, and now we're down to, I think, 20 cents, depending on the region. So because debt is not used for productive purposes, but it's used to speculate and to buy back stocks, etc. But you say now easily we have a need for significant deleveraging. Mm. But how should it work? Because my understanding is deleveraging is bad for growth. Because how should this work? Or what is a realistic way of achieving deleveraging?
Well, what I've proposed for some time now, and I never thought it would be actually taken seriously, which is why I haven't written detailed academic papers on it so far, is what I call a modern debt jubilee. Because if you look at the historical society, going back to ancient Sumeria, Israel, Rome, and Rome before the empire and so on, there were regular debt jubilees. And they were debt jubilees against household debt, not against corporate debt, roughly every 49 years or every change of emperor, which was, of the order of, say, every 15 to 20 years. And what that meant was people had become debt slaves because they were unable to pay their debts and they had to go through and work on the creditor's land, were liberated and to go back and work on their own land periodically, which was a major way of maintaining some form of social cohesion in those societies. Now, we can't do that today because if you wrote the debt off, you'd bankrupt the financial sector. You'd bankrupt people who've got legitimately owning government bonds and corporate bonds and so on. But if you understand the modern monetary system, it's quite feasible for the government operating through the Treasury, operating through the central bank, to give everybody an equal amount of money, whether you're a creditor or whether you're a borrower or not, every non-bank citizen gets an equal amount of money. Those who have debt are required to pay their debt down, or you'd set it up automatically so the debt was paid off or an offset was established against their debt. Those who don't have debt would get cash. And if I wanted to use it strictly just to reduce the level of debt overall, I would then require the individuals who got who didn't have debt, who therefore got money they didn't have to use to pay off their own debt, would have to buy newly issued corporate shares, where those corporate shares could only be used to pay off corporate debt. So you get a combination of a drastic reduction in the debt level. I've hypothesized in the American case of a modern debt jubilee using $100,000 per adult in America. That's equivalent to 110% of GDP. If you imagine a 50-50 split between debtors and non-debtors, then that would reduce household debt from 80% of GDP to about 30%. And then the households who didn't have debt would end up buying a large amount of corporate shares. Corporate debt would also fall from about 80% to 30% of GDP. And you'd have a more democratized capitalist system, wider ownership of shares, no change in the amount of money in the economy, no additional monetary demand coming out of this, but a resetting. So rather than having too much of a credit-based monetary system and not enough of a fiat, you'd go back to something like the balance that applied back in the 50s and 60s when the balance was about 50-50 between credit-created money and fiat-created money. So it could be done. I never thought it would be done, but after coronavirus, there's always a possibility that it might be done.
So I've got two questions here. One question is around what would be the impact on asset prices? Because I could imagine that if you have less access to leverage after such a reset.
Yeah.
This has a negative impact on asset prices, which would also affect many people and also the financial sector. And the second question is, it sounds to me a little bit like the Chicago plan. You know, remember Irving Fisher's Chicago plan?
Indeed.
Where he basically was saying, we stop credit-based money. You know, excuse me if I have used the wrong words, the credit-based money, but we go to sovereign money, basically forcing everybody to use only money which was created by the central bank.
Yeah.
Could you elaborate there?
Yeah. I mean, I'll go back. I'll talk about the Chicago plan and credit-based versus fiat money, first of all, and then the impact on asset prices. So I'm not a fan of the outright Chicago plan because that would actually mean the abolition of the capacity for banks to create money. And though I'm completely agree, of course, banks have used that capacity to finance asset bubbles, and dramatically so in house prices over the last 25 years, and also, of course, the share market now as well. So we've got massively overinflated asset prices courtesy of that lending. But at the same time, if you look particularly at the German situation with lots of small regional banks, as Richard Werner argues, those small banks are a major reason why small corporations in Germany get finance for working capital and for investment. That doesn't apply in countries like America or the UK or Australia, where I'm from, where there's these huge banks and they do all their lending on point scoring, and whether you have assets to bank the lending is all they really care about. If you had local bank managers who knew the local would-be entrepreneurs and managers, they get to learn who's good and who's bad, and they provide working capital for them, and you therefore get a dispersed industrial base that Germany has. My favorite experience there, by the way, was I spoke at a conference in Bonn, I think in about 2011, and I was invited by my host to stay at his house, which happened to be 130 miles from Bonn in a small village of about 5,000 people. We had a function that night around the local volcanic caldera and walked past an old couple sitting on a park bench, and he had a chat to them and walked away. And then he said, they run the major business in the village. And my guess was making sauerkraut. And I said, what's their business? He said, making satellites. And meeting people in a local village of 5,000 people whose major business was making satellites is a sign of just how diversified the German economy is, but also the role of small German banks in providing working capital to entrepreneurs that they know. And that's why if we can restrict private banking to providing money for working capital for corporations, consumption funding for households, for large consumption items they can't afford outright, then that's a creative role that is advantageous for a private banking system. But with the banking systems in the West totally aggregated, mass central banks, all on point scoring, all they really do is look at whether you have collateral to back the amount of money you want to borrow. If you have collateral, you get the money. If you don't have collateral, you don't get the money. What that means is, of course, that lending finances asset bubbles. And that's what we've seen. And then to make it even worse, and this is where I blame the Federal Reserve in particular and Ben Bernanke with quantitative easing. The whole idea of quantitative easing was to make people feel wealthier so that they would spend more money. That's quite literally in a 2010 paper by Bernanke. The objective was to make people feel wealthier so they'd spend more and it would be good for the economy. Well, only people who had shares felt wealthier. So what you've had is a massive increase in inequality, first of all, caused by the private debt bubble and its impact upon asset prices. And then it's been compounded by the Federal Reserve and central banks around the world, including the ECB, also inflating asset prices by QE. So I think asset prices have to come down, period, and come down quite substantially. So in doing that, we're going to have a lot of people who'll be complaining about it. But there are people equally who can no longer buy into those markets. And I think we're on the edge where, particularly in America, there's very little way that anybody who doesn't already own a home can afford to buy one. And what we're seeing is people are now borrowing money off their parents to go and buy a house. And what you're getting ultimately is all the ownership of the assets is sending up in the financial sector. It is not at all. It is a very destructive way to get wealthy. And we have to reduce asset prices, but also make it not matter to people that has happened as much as it would if you simply had a total asset price collapse right now. And that largely comes down again to reducing the level of leverage. So yes, I do want to see asset prices fall. If you look at the brilliant Case-Shiller index, cyclically adjusted price to earnings ratio for America, the average for that ratio is about the order of 14. It's currently about 30, and it's only being higher during 2000. The ratio now is higher than it was at the peak of the stock market bubble in 1929. So asset prices are far too high. Central banks have spent their energy defending asset prices rather than the real economy, and all this has to stop.
But if asset prices fall, it's not only uncomfortable, but it's also a problem for the people who still have debt. Because in your model, if everyone gets $100,000, this might be nice, but let's assume I bought a flat in New York or in whatever, London, and it cost me $1 million, and I might have, you know, $800,000 in debt on it or $700,000 in debt.
Yep.
And if then asset prices come down, and if you assume such a big deleveraging, asset prices, you know, it's not going to go from $1 million to $900,000, but it's going to go from $1 million to $500,000, which would then mean that the one who had $700,000 in debt is underwater. So how would you deal with this?
That is, I'm not going to say this is without problems. Okay. So it would definitely have challenges about that, particularly people whose net positive asset valuation was based on enormous levels of leverage, and their paper wealth would go below zero quite rapidly if you had a large fall in asset prices. But to me, we need to get a world where we worry more about the economy than asset prices, and. I'm not going to say it can be done overnight and it'd be easy to get to a different world and everybody's going to be equally happy. There will be a massive redistribution of income away from the wealthy back towards the poor. And that, I think, is also vital. We cannot sustain, I think politically and socially, we can't sustain the level of inequality we have now. And as Nick Hanoer puts it, talking to his fellow billionaires, the pitchforks are coming. If you don't do something about the level of inequality, there's going to be political consequences for them in the future. So, you know, basically, we've inflated asset prices far too much for the last, really ever since the 1987 stock market crash. We've been pushing asset prices up ever since then. This has to come to an end. And of course, it won't be easy. It won't be straightforward. There will be unintended consequences. But I think the unintended consequences of where we are now is far worse than in a world where we managed to reduce the level of private debt.
So, but, okay, you say you're in favor of a debt jubilee in a well-organized way. Everyone gets money, uses either to pay back debt or to buy up corporate shares in order to help corporations to deleverage. I understood this. Mm-hmm. You're not in favor of going to sovereign money because, a decentralized banking system like the German banking system is much better in creating credit for productive uses. Would this be enough to avoid a repetition of the crisis? Or would you say, well, we need to have more regulations like demanding higher equity share when you take on a credit, or demanding a change in tax laws so that interest expenses are treated like dividends? Or what would be your view in this regard?
Yeah, well, we need a whole range of reforms of the financial sector. And one of the most obvious to me is we have to stop we have to break the positive feedback loop that exists at the moment, the amplifying feedback loop between leverage and asset prices. So I would add a rule to the financial sector that the amount of money which can be lent to buy an asset can be no more than a multiple of the income earning potential of that asset. So if you look at a house, where I was living in London before I moved to Thailand, I was paying £1,500, which is £18,000 a year to rent that property. Now, my rule would be what I call the PIL, which stands for Property Income Limited Leverage. And I would make a rule that a house which is rented for £18,000 a year, no one, from myself to the Prince Charles and Rupert Murdoch, could borrow more than 10 times that to buy the house. So the maximum debt anybody could take up would be £180,000. And therefore, the person who would win the battle in buying it would be the one who saved more money, not the one who borrowed more money. So as a rule like that, and absolutely blanket rule, no exceptions, a rule like that would potentially break the positive feedback between leverage and asset prices we currently have. Because at the moment, if you and I were fighting to buy some place in Westminster, and we earned the same income, the one of us who would win would be one who has a high level of leverage. And we actually have a personal encouragement to want to have banks lend more money. But if it was the stage where the banks couldn't lend more than a fixed amount, then the one of us who would win the battle would be the one who saved more. And you wouldn't get the amplifying feedback we currently have between private debt and house prices. A similar thing with shares. I would limit shares so that after a certain, hypothetically say 5 or 10 sales of a share, it would become a Jubilee share, which would continue paying dividends but expire after 50 years. And in that way, it wouldn't be sensible to take out the level of margin debt people are currently taking out to buy share prices. So we have to bring in rules that stop the financial sector causing asset bubbles, which is all they're doing at the moment.
You think debt jubilee might be an option, still it might be not the most probable option. What might be the alternatives for politicians to reduce the debt level?
There really isn't one. In terms of reducing debt levels, the research done by my colleague Richard Vague, a book called The Brief History of Doom, had a research team taking a look at about 160 financial crises throughout history and said the only way the debt's been reduced after one of those crises, apart from two or three cases, is by debt write-offs. Now, he has other ideas about how to do that, so he's an ex-banker. And they said one thing is that at the moment, banks, when they have to write debt off, they're required to write it off in one go, which means if you have $1 million debt, which is not going to be repaid, you have to write $1 million off your equity in that year. And that can, of course, with enough of that happening, you can handle that on a episodic basis, but it becomes systemic, which is what happened in the financial crisis, then the bank goes bankrupt, which is what you don't want. So he's talking about giving banks, say, 20 years to write that sort of debt off. So except they write debt down, but take a hit over a 10, 15, 20-year period to their equity base rather than taking it all at once. So there is more than just one option, more than one way to get about reducing debt, but they all ultimately involve writing that debt off. It simply is not the case that economy can grow out of debt. The cases where he has found that happen are countries like Saudi Arabia, where their debt levels were eliminated by the fact that the oil price increased by a factor of 4 in 1 year. Now, that is, of course, something that only happens for one or two countries, one or two times in history. For the rest of us, you simply have to accept that it has to be written off.
And the point is, the Germans would, of course, say, well, isn't it unfair? If debt is written off, those who have taken on debt, they are the winners, because they not only do they have the assets, but they are the winners. And those actually, because in Germany, debt and schuld and sin is similar. You could also say, well, it's good for those who sinned and it's bad for those who saved.
Which is why for a modern debt jubilee, where you do it for everybody, independent of whether they're in debt or not. So I prefer the modern debt jubilee approach to simply writing off debt, because that, as you say, benefits those who speculated. It doesn't benefit those who didn't speculate. So whatever we do has to be something that is fair. And now partly that also means that people who have been on the bottom of the economic pyramid for the last 20 or 30 years, they've suffered because they are on the bottom. There's no way that the average worker has benefited out of soaring house prices or soaring share prices. There's an enormous amount of inequality which is unearned. People have become extremely wealthy on the basis of leverage speculation, and often not through any conscious action of their own, because they've got a block of land whose price has been driven up by the general increase in leverage and house prices as a result of that. So there's an enormous unfairness already in the system. And if we try to pretend that we have to maintain the current unfairness out of whatever we do for the future, we won't get anywhere. And my real feeling is that maybe all this will be irrelevant anyway, because what's really going to change what happens economically is climate change. And that is going to upset everybody's apple cart. The ultimate thing we have to be fair to is the ecology. And if we try to maintain the unfair system we have now in the face of that, we won't have a system at all.
Okay, but I promise to you, we probably will have a discussion, if you are still willing after this podcast, to discuss with me another one about climate change policies. But I would like to ask specifically around inflation, because many people say, well, After the Second World War, we had financial repression. Okay, I would say it was for reducing debt levels of governments relative to GDP and not of the private sector, but it helps the private sector as well. Don't you think that more inflationary policies, also given now what Mr. Biden is doing, that this is going to help to reduce the debt levels relative to GDP in a relatively pain-free way?
In fact, the private debt levels and government, private debt levels rose throughout, looking in America data in particular, private debt rose right from 1945 on. So there's never a period where private debt was falling in a trend way. Government debt was falling, but that was in the context of low inflation and government deficits. If you go back to the 90s, if you look at the data of the 50s and 60s, and I do that in the New Economics and Manifesto, I've got a little table there that summarizes inflation, deficits, debt levels, and so on over the 50 to 70 period, the post-73 period, and then the post-financial crisis period. And so it was not the case that inflation reduced the level of government debt. And in fact, private debt rose during a period of low inflation, government fell during a period of low inflation. So I don't think we can rely upon inflation alone. If you did have a huge inflationary surge, then yes, that would reduce the outstanding debt burden.
Now we spoke always about the quote-unquote easy case, the U.S., because the U.S. has one economy, has one currency, it's probably also more aggressive and more innovative when it comes to policy measures. Let's jump to Europe, and specifically to the EU and the Eurozone. Especially for the Eurozone, it's a big issue because we have countries with high debt levels. I speak about government. We have countries with low government debt, like Italy, the Netherlands, and Germany. On the other hand, we have countries with high private debt levels, and people don't realize that the private debt level in the Netherlands is much higher than Italy or Germany. We have countries like France with very high debt levels. We have obviously here a bit more complicated situation. So what's your view on the Eurozone in this context?
Well, I think the Eurozone is a disaster. It always has been a disaster. And I always go back to quoting the work of Wynne Godley back in 1992, looking at the Euro and saying, people are giving up the capacity to vary their exchange rates and giving up the capacity to run fiscal policy all at the one time. And this will mean that when a crisis comes along, they'll be forced into doing austerity at a time when their economy needs stimulatory government spending. And that's exactly what's happened. And particularly with the Maastricht Treaty rules being so extreme, focusing upon government debt and ignoring private debt, with a sensible analysis, it's private debt that matters, not government debt. So it's an insanely bad system, and it is always going to be inadequate for any system, any situation of crisis whatsoever. So the best thing would be to abolish it. And like if you look at, in terms of just looking now at my own data to see which countries actually meet the current rules of the Maastricht Treaty. And at the moment, the only country, in fact, it's not even part of the Maastricht Treaty, Denmark, that's the only country with a debt level below 60% of GDP for government debt. The Netherlands is 65% or so. Italy is 170%. France is 140%. Germany is 80%. The Netherlands, it's a disaster. And the only, its objective was to get to a situation which it's moved further away from during its own time.
Yeah, but the point is, I think it's a bit more, in my view, it's a bit more complicated because, you know, we have different government debt levels. We have also different deficits. On the other hand, we also have very different levels of private wealth. So, which is very interesting because if you take private wealth in relation to GDP, so to income, Italians have much more private wealth than the Dutch or the Germans, for example. Which has to do with ownership of real estate, which also has to do probably with how people save and invest. But clearly there are some imbalances. So we have the issue around different government debt levels. We have the issue around different private debt levels. And we have the issue around different private wealth levels. So obviously politicians will not be willing to follow your advice and abolish it. So what would you propose, you know, is there a proposal you would have on your mind on how to fix it?
I think you've got to go back to national currencies. I think the euro should never have been more than a form of inter-country trade within the European Union. And fundamentally, just it's a mistake. And the only fix a mistake is by reversing it. So I would find a way to reintroduce national currencies.
But now the EU has said, look, we take on more debt on a European level. And I would say, well, if it's on a European level, it's similar to debt of the United States. So, and if we both follow the MMT theory or approach, we would say, well, you know, we are basically creating money. Then the only issue is that we have to distribute the money equally on all countries and not necessarily only for the countries in quote unquote need. If everyone increases debt, the Germans as well, then we all benefit and it could be moving, you know, abolishing austerity.
If the European Union recognised that the governments create money when running deficits and don't need to borrow it from the private sector and weren't obsessed about the level of government debt, abolish that 60% rule, abolish the 3% rule, then you might well be able to make it work. But of course, you have the problem that you can't allow inflation rates to diverge too much between different countries, because that's what I used to cause exchange rate movements, which of course are no longer possible when you have a single currency. So you still have it'd be a very fractious continental governmental system in trying to make sure that the Germans didn't annoy the French, who didn't annoy the Italians, who didn't annoy the Greeks, etc., etc. So it'd be feasible to do it by saying, let's recognize that government debt is not a problem, and therefore abolish those rules of the Maastricht Treaty. But it would be a big ask. I mean, I think the level of animosity amongst Europeans has risen over the last 20 years, the opposite of what people would hope would happen by having a single currency. So yes, dramatically increasing the budget of the European Union, funding what national parliaments pass, allowing them to have deficits of as much as is necessary at various times, 10% of GDP is quite feasible, then yes, you could do it. But I politically, I think it's impossible.
So basically, if you always take the point around, you know, government deficits don't matter, I would just like to dive a bit deeper in here, because I listen to your podcast, I understand that MMT is perfect in accounting, I understand the system, I understand that it's creating money, but on the other hand, is there no limit at all? Could you say we go to 500%, 1,000% of GDP, because it just doesn't matter?
In terms of government debt levels, you can't go there too quickly. The story always is you don't want the financial system driving the physical economy too far. Okay, you don't want to get to the stage you have under capacity, dragging in imports because you can't produce enough domestic demand, et cetera, et cetera. That's not what you want to get to. But Europe is so far from that, you know, that making that a worry is a bit like being worried about being able to walk from Paris to the White Cliffs of Dover. It is such a huge distance from where the European Union is right now, at the level of, particularly in Spain, as you know how bad underemployment is in Spain. So you can handle a far higher level of government debt than you have right now. And of course, the main point is, I mean, as they're saying, the attempt to control government debt using the euro has failed abjectly anyway. And we look at Japan. I mean, Japan is running, I think Japan's government debt level is 240% of GDP. Its inflation rate is zero. You know, its unemployment rate is low, but not as low as it was back in the 70s and 80s. So you've seen countries achieving levels which are four times what the Maastricht Treaty try to set as a maximum, and the economy is functioning far better than the European Union while still having slack. So I think the empirical argument is strongly in favour of saying, let's embrace the knowledge of MMT, realising what the dangers might be, but realise we're so far from those dangers right now that it's ludicrous to worry about them.
Steve, we've got elections upcoming in Germany, and most of my listeners sit in Germany, and they might ask, Well, what does your assessment of the situation for the European Union and the Eurozone actually imply for Germany? Because the current answer of Germans is we raise taxes, or we have a long discussion now, we have to raise taxes in order to pay for the corona crisis. That's what I said from politicians. There's also the discussion around we have to have higher taxes in order to fight inequality, although as the income redistribution, Germany works quite well. So after tax, after redistribution, incomes is quite low. The Gini coefficient is 0.29, so which is pretty, you know, like Scandinavia nearly. We have a bit have a wealth inequality, but it's only due to the fact that our rich are not richer than the others, but our middle class has not so many assets because of high taxation and low real estate ownership. And as the Germans say, okay, we have to raise taxes to pay for our deficit, and we have to enter a transfer union. So we have to pay money to Brussels for redistribution to other countries in order to stabilize the system. So let's assume the new government were to hire you in October and say, Steve, what should we do? What should we do in our role as the European Union and the Eurozone, and what should we do for our own economy? What would be your advice?
Well, mainly, I mean, one way Germany has been successful is suppressing wages for a long time. I think you have to get away from the emphasis on low wages, which has been a major reason for its comparative success within the European Union itself. I would enable the government to run a larger deficit, which it needs to do to keep the private sector going bankrupt after coronavirus. Germany itself, in terms of private debt, Germany has one of the lowest levels of private debt in the world. So you don't have the private debt dilemma that exists there. But you do have, Germany is having, your airport for Berlin is a classic instance of a failed infrastructure project. You have done fairly well on the energy transition, but you need to go further with that. I mean, I know there's been problems with the solar systems as well, and shutting down nuclear power stations, which I think was a mistake. So there's a range of Germany, though, has come out. I mean, this is one of the reasons people are critical of the European Union overall. Germany has done pretty well out of it. So I wouldn't see Germany specifically having too many problems compared to the rest of the European Union. What they're worried about is the rest of Europe causing problems for Germany. And I think on that basis, I'd say that accept that government debt is not a problem in the way the Maastricht Treaty was drafted, because government does not borrow to create money. Government creates money by spending. It is not actually borrowing from the private sector. All the shibboleths that have dominated that people think about government debt coming from neoclassical economics are simply wrong. So you don't need to be worried about the level of government debt. It is more of a problem when you don't have your own currency, which is why the European Union, another reason why it was a mistake. But being a currency creator is a major part of being able to make use of MMT. So the solution would be, unfortunately, in some ways, to give more power to Brussels. But at the same time, to say Brussels has to accept the deficits that are being planned by its nation states and fund them with far more freedom than has been allowed in the future. I've seen reports just recently about Germany saying Spain has to start cutting back on its spending. That'd be disastrous. So I'd be saying you've to Germans in general, though the European Union was a mistake in terms of the currency, the euro was a mistake. You've come fairly well of that mistake. Don't be too worried about letting others escape from the damaging effect of that mistake upon those economies.
But I would also add, probably it would be also wiser to spend more money in Germany and not raise taxes, but rather work on a program of saying, okay, fine, if you now accept everyone is running higher deficits, the Germans should also run higher deficits, and the German government should allow private citizens to build up some wealth, because having some wealth, having some ownership of stocks or whatever, also we have... especially in light of the inequality issues, it would be better to have a program of making sure that the Germans not only have a huge trade surplus, but they also have a benefit from it, having higher wages, but also having higher private wealth.
Yeah, I think that's true.
Last question is, I floated an idea and I would like to get your feedback on it, because I said, you know, we Germans are very obsessed with public debt, as you know. And I'm critical around the transfer union aspect because I believe that, first of all, transfers from Germany to the others can never be big enough to fix the problems because that requires much bigger deficits, as you pointed out. And secondly, I believe that once we really embark on transfer union, it's going to split Europe even further. Now, the Dutch, the Austrians, they were already very critical on the so-called reconstruction fund. And I would say that all the Germans will be over time more and more unhappy if they spend huge amounts of money for South Italy or whatever. Mm. Well, my proposal was to say, why don't we pool existing debt on a European level? So have a kind of I call it debt redemption fund on a European scale, but everyone participates. All the Germany would participate. And let's take 80% debt of GDP of pre-corona GDP. Everyone puts 80% of its debt in a joint fund on a European scale, and this fund is going to be refinanced by perpetual loans.
That is fairly similar to Yanis Varoufakis' proposal for Greece back in 2008. So a consolidation of that debt on the books of the ECB rather than on the books of national governments makes eminent sense.
And I would say everyone has to participate because then we don't have a discussion about equality that those, again, the sinners, in quote unquote, with higher debt levels benefit more than those with low debt levels. If the Dutch and the Germans and the Austrians benefit as well, this might be probably a way of supporting it.
That's feasible.
Steve, thank you very much for your time. And if you're willing, I would be very happy if you could continue this in a few months and have a deep dive on what you would do to fight climate change, if you agree.
Sure, that'd be fine. I'd look forward to it. Good to talk to you, Daniel.
Thank you very much for joining us today. I look forward to welcoming you again in the future for another edition of English Language Interviews of the podcast BTO Beyond the Obvious 2.0. I'm Daniel Stelter. Thank you very much for tuning in.
BTO, Beyond the Obvious 2.0.